grief is one that is a real necessity of being able to process both positive and negative experiences. And there's learning in it. And so what actually happens in the process of grief, that people actually learn something. They may learn something about themselves, may learn something about another individual, learn how they cope and their coping mechanisms. And so it becomes that rocket that pounds into people's lives and brings them up short to really evaluate their life.
I'm Gerardo Poli.
I'm Hubert Hemstra, and this is The Vet Vault.
I remember arriving on shift one day and seeing a box of tissues on the floor of an empty consult room next to a small patch of shaved hair and a half-empty cup of tea. I was surprised and slightly bemused to find that I was suddenly swallowing hard and blinking back some tears. What was this thing that hides behind a half-open consult room door and pounces on you at the sight of these seemingly innocent objects? Of course, what I'd recognized in that room was the evidence of a scene where our old friend Grief had made an appearance. You'd be well familiar with it. We bump into Grief several times in an average day at a vet clinic. But do you understand Grief? Do you face it head-on, or does it make you uncomfortable, so you run and hide when you see it coming? Do you even see it coming? Can you recognize the stages of grief in your clients, your co-workers, and what about yourself? Did you know, for example, that when that client is lashing out and being a total a-hole, it may just be that they are stuck in one of the stages of grief, and that with the right tools, you can help them guide them to a more appropriate stage? Don't worry, neither did we. So we invited our friend Rhonda Andrews back to give us some guidance and strategies for dealing with grief in more constructive ways. You'll remember Rhonda from episode 47 on trauma and burnout. And if you listen to that one, you'll know that she is a psychologist with almost 3 decades of experience and that she is the principal psychologist and managing director at the Barrington Center, which provides organizational and personal psychological services to a large number of sectors, both in Australia and abroad, for industries like government, education, legal, entertainment, and emergency services. We also told you about the program that Rhonda and her team have adapted for the vet profession called Systems of Support, or SOS, which is a positive psychological health program that was designed for high-stress professions. It's an evidence-based program that helps to reduce the negative psychological impacts associated with work that can lead to the all-familiar things in our profession, like anxiety, burnout, depression, and, in extreme cases, to suicide. What's new since we last spoke about SOS is that the University of Queensland have evaluated the program and have recently released a report on SOS, confirming the validity and reliability of the program with over 700 participants to date. And if you love the content of this episode and find it useful, you'll be thrilled to learn that Rhonda and her team are helping to roll out this kind of counselling support to all veterinary teams in March of this year, when they are launching an employee assist program specifically for veterinary teams. I had to ask what an employee assist program was, or EAP. An EAP is a service offered to staff of any business that's either partially or fully funded for staff to get them started with counseling with a psychologist if they really need it. Basically, making sure that cost is never a reason for a team member not to seek help when they need it. What makes this EAP unique is that they are working with veterinarian Dr. Louisa Johnson, who you'll also remember from the last episode with Rhonda, to train the psychs on the unique challenges that faces us in Vetland, which you would appreciate would be critical for the success of such a program. Okay, back to our episode. Join us as we back this slightly scary beast into a corner. I'll be the bum stop, Gerardo can be the head tapper, while Rhonda examines grief. But before I let you go, you know that I'm going to remind you about our subscriber-exclusive series of clinical podcasts. Go to vvn.supercast.com to get the details about what I believe is the most useful ongoing clinical learning out there in Small Is Medicine, Surgery, and ECC. Useful because you'll use it. And because you use it, you'll learn stuff and get more confident in your knowledge. Before you know it, you'll be that vet in the clinic. You know the one. The one with all the cool insights and who's totally up to date with what's new and what the cool kids in Vetland are doing with their patients. All right, let's talk about grief. Why do we want to... Well, let's say hello. Hello, Rhonda. How are you? Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed, Hubert. Welcome and glad to be back with you.
Why do we want to talk about grief? Our goal with the Vet Vault, again, is to help people have sustainable, fulfilling careers as vets. But I feel like grief is something we bump into. But as a bunch of scientists or A-type personality, logical people, it's one of those fuzzy things. And I think we're not all that comfortable with it. We don't understand it. So we just sort of push it aside and go, yeah, it's there. But let's not talk about it and move straight ahead. And I think Rhonda's going to fix that for us today, hopefully.
Well, I hope so. But I think, as you said, Hubert, it is something that some people do have a great deal of discomfort speaking about it and the feelings that come with it. But I think, to be quite realistic, we know within our vet industry, grief is a daily phenomenon. And we need to have it that both nurses and vets and administration staff feel comfortable with the whole process of grief.
And that could even be clients who are grieving because of the euthanasia. And sometimes it's like, whoa, you're super grieving in a way that I've never experienced before, and I don't feel comfortable knowing what to do or what to say.
Yeah. And that's a good point there, Gerardo. Yes, I do want to talk about that interface between and the connection between the vet or the vet nurse and the client, because at those times there's a lot of emotional transference that goes on, and there's a lot that the vets and the vet nurses actually do take on board just by default because of the intensity of the situation right there, particularly around euthanasia.
Yeah, we talked in the previous chat about vicarious trauma. Is this similar? Do you have, does this fall under the same basket, really?
Not the same way. That what we've got happening here is much more about cumulative trauma. So what I'm really wanting to focus on today is not so much of just that transference there, Hubert, but more of the frequency at which it happens, so that, you know, we can deal with, say, one, and then we've got two, and then we might have three. And, you know, as I've heard from various after-hours veterinary practices, they might have in any one shift up to 70% around euthanasia or around some form of loss. And so that's a phenomenal amount in one shift. And so if we're talking about multiple shifts for each employee, then we really want to be looking at how do we actually break the cumulative trauma that they would experience around that. And that's what I'd like to touch on today.
Can I jump in with, before we start analyzing grief, and I hope that you can give us a nice scientific explanation of it, because that's just how our brains work. But the first thing is, and what I'm personally curious about is, why do we have it? Is it a useful emotion? Does it have a purpose? Or is it just an annoying negative emotion that we've got to suffer through and get out on the other side? Because I sort of feel like if evolution selected for something to stay in us, that it probably has a reason.
Yep. It's a good point you raise, and it does have a scientific purpose that just, and the stages I'll go through in a moment, but grief is one that is a real necessity of being able to process both positive and negative experiences, and there's learning in it. And so what actually happens in the process of grief, that people actually learn something. They may learn something about themselves, may learn something about another individual, learn how they cope and their coping mechanisms. So it then actually builds a greater strength in them, or it actually gets them to actually start making some decisions about their life. And so it becomes quite a, at times, confronting process that people then look at my life. And, you know, that's a classic would be people who have moved into just full-on work all the time, and grief is, if you like, the door stopper that says, hang on a moment, is this the life you really want to lead? And so it becomes that rocket that pounds runs into people's lives and brings them up short to really evaluate their life. And some people make some pretty major life decisions post-grief. But we've always got a warning on it, and that is don't make them too close in the grief process, because otherwise they may not be the long-term decisions that you want to make.
Is it because most of the times grief is painful and the decisions that you make are avoiding pain and moving away from pain?
Yep.
And that just as a decision-making process is one that's more survival as opposed to one that's more logical.
Correct. Absolutely spot on. That's a lovely way of putting it, that it is about avoidance and it is about survival. And so therefore it's about how do I minimize that pain right here and right now? And those decisions may be good for the short term, but they don't serve people generally well in the long term. And so exactly, it doesn't bring in any logic. And so by moving away from the job, you know, I'm moving out of this career. I'm not going to be a vet any longer. I'm out of here. Looks great for the first couple of weeks, first month, but then where are you? What have you got? And so it's sort of that 0 to 100 doesn't always deal with the longer term. So we always say to people, great to look at these things, great to evaluate and get better perspective on life, but hold off. And we generally say to people after some major trauma, hold off for a few months and then revisit your decisions and then enact them.
Is there something that we should think about with regards to grief? Like generally we're grieving because of a loss, but that loss in itself, the experience of loss, it's innately in us to develop such strong connections with each other, because together we, as a community, as a family, we work better, and like to have those strong bonds keeps everyone alive. And then so therefore grief is the pain that you experience from the breakage of those bonds, but in a way the pain of the grief is a reflection of how strong the bond was. Maybe is that a
And generally there is a direct correlation between the pain and that connection. And we do see that when, you know, we have a client that is grieving, and I'll speak about the various stages in a moment, but when, you know, they're in that stage of denial or in the stage of where they're really angry, you know, they're really connected. So the client's very connected to their animal. And so there's a very, very strong bond. And so there's an equal amount of pain that goes with that. And then so too for the vet, they may know of the animal and have treated the animal for some years or intensely over a short period of time. So there's a short-term but intense connection as well. So the connection is one of longevity, but also the connection is what's brought those animal or persons together, and what's the bond, what's connected them. And it could be that it's a parallel in the vet's life. So for instance, a client might be saying, this was my wife's dog and she's now passed away, and so I can't let her die because that's my connection to my wife. Or my child suicided and this was his dog. And so therefore, cat, and therefore it's my job in life to keep this cat going for as long as possible. And so they'll even ignore the logic of the pain that animal might be suffering, because for them it's the connection to their loved one that is now deceased. And they certainly pass that on to the vet. You can't let this animal die.
Yeah, yeah, and that's all too common.
So I'm just wondering, Hubert and Gerardo, is this a good time? Let's frame it up so then we can see, okay, what are the steps that people go through? And I really want to put it into, we're going to normalize grief, because it is a process that we all go through. And vets in particular, there's uniqueness there that I want to speak about. But I think what's important is There's no one size fits all in the grief cycle. And I'm going to talk about a cycle developed by a psychiatrist called Kubler-Ross. And Elizabeth put this together, and the topic in her book was on death and dying. And it's very good because it actually refers to five stages of grief. And what's important is they aren't linear. And they are not in a consecutive way that you can keep on rotating and jumping all over those five stages, depending on the individuals. Okay. And so it's something that is very fluid according to what people are dealing with and what other impacts and variables are in their lives. Okay. So the common one you firstly see is denial. And the client will look confused. And so they might say things like, when you're saying that the pet's deteriorating, and that's a pretty obvious statement you're making, but the client might say, what do you mean? And for you, it's like, well, I can't tell you any clearer than that. The pet's deteriorating. But the denial is a slowing down of the cognitive processing for the individual so they have time to process the trauma or the impact of the information that you're giving them. So denial is a really good take the foot off the accelerator so I can slow down the amount you're giving to me at one time about it. So when you see a client keep on asking lots and lots and lots of questions, that is their way of slowing down the process of absorbing the severity of what you're saying to them.
Okay, so can I interrupt for a sec? So that might look like this client's being really difficult, or this client is stupid or something, and I'm talking to them and they're just not listening. What the hell is wrong with them? But would that just be the start of the grieving process for them?
Yeah, exactly. That's part of their denial. So, yeah, you'll be saying, well, how clearer can I make this to them? And, yeah, are they being difficult? But in actual fact, it's just their way of putting the brakes on.
Okay.
Another way they might do it is they keep missing your calls and they don't call you back. So you're leaving messages to say, I need to talk to you urgently about your cat or your dog, and they avoid you. And you're thinking, wouldn't you think they'd be jumping on the phone as quickly as possible? Or they'd have their phone right glued to their ear waiting for my call. So once again, it looks like, why is this happening?
Like almost like a lack of caring from their side.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it may look like a lack of caring or a sense of disregard. But once again, it is often part of the denial process. You know, I mean, there'll be some that don't care, but majority will care. And that's part of their first part of denial. So what's really important, because denial actually stops people hearing a lot of information. And so in any conversation you're having with people when they're in the denial phase, they only pick up approximately 5% of your content. So keep it brief, keep it simple. Do not get into jargon because they will never hear it. And what you'll do is actually perpetuate the denial phase because they'll just go round and round in questioning all the time. The next stage, and as I say, I'm calling it stages, but people can jump all over the place. Another stage is anger. And so, you know, you'll hear clients might say to veterinary staff when the pet dies unexpectedly, you killed my dog. If you cared for her better, this would not have happened. You're a terrible vet or you're a terrible nurse. And so for them, it's part of their anger. It's part of their own lack of control, their own sense of responsibility that they have failed. And so, therefore, they transfer their anger onto the veterinary staff. And so you'll hear them lash out in anything, and they'll be accusatory, they will be bombastic, and they will be incredibly degrading at times. And I think that's really important that We recognise that, but at the same time, we recognise that staff, veterinary staff, don't have to deal with abuse either. And so it's really important that, yes, we can accept and expect there's going to be a rant, but at the same time, it's really important that veterinary staff don't feel like they're just going to sit there and cop it. And so, you know, statements like, I know you're terribly upset, but it's not actually okay to talk to the staff like that or talk to me like that. So what you're doing is you're deliberately containing and constraining what they're saying. Otherwise, what happens is they just keep on escalating. And you actually have to bring, if you like, a limit and boundary on that.
Okay, so you would, in a way, kind of try to slow down their roll, like, because it could roll and spiral, and then they get more emotive and more energized in a negative way, and then they get louder, and then you've got to kind of catch it in a way. Catching it in a way is a hard one because you want to allow them to be heard, have their say, get it out, but then they could go on for ages and start storming up and down the hallway in front of every other client.
Exactly, and you're quite right, there is that balance between and don't give them an audience. It's really important not for them to see other clients, to actually, if you can, put them into a room quite separate, because it fuels them. Unconsciously, it fuels them. What you want to do is not give them that audience. And the other thing is, yes, as you said, Gerardo, it's important for them to let it out. The key thing is just to keep on saying a really important message of, we know by your reaction just how much you loved your pet. So what you're doing is you're bypassing the anger, and you don't say, stop doing that. Stop doing that, because as soon as you say stop doing it, they're just going to keep rocketing. Yeah. So what you do is you cut underneath it and say, we know you loved Jackie, or we know you loved Billy. Because what that will do is that will de-escalate the anger, and pretty much people then shift rapidly from anger to crying.
Because it's the acknowledgement of their because Alex has a good line. It's kind of along the lines of, you know, I could see from your words and how you're feeling how important Fluffy was for you, and I can see how much you love Fluffy. But and then roll into try to segue, move things forward into, but I'm here to help. But what you're trying to do is what you said there is shift it from anger to love.
Exactly. Yep. So in a sense, you're ignoring the anger. You don't give anger any more fuel or oxygen. And what you do is just say, this, you know, how you are shows me how much you love Fluffy and how important Fluffy was to you and how lucky Fluffy was to have you as an owner.
I like this so much. This is so useful, because what happens is we see those reactions. But when we fail to recognize it as a grief stage, you just think, what an asshole, or this is so personal. That client is so angry, it must be my fault. Or you get angry and you see it and you go, screw you, buddy. You can't talk to me that way. And then you jump in with your attitude and it just explodes.
You're quite right. And the thing is that often people feel forced into justifying their position. Like when I'm in the anger phase and I'm saying, you've killed my dog, or, you know, you're a shit vet, you feel like you've got to justify what you've just done. That's the last thing you need to do. All you need to do is bypass all of that and just say, your reaction has told me just how much you love Fluffy. So you bypass, but as soon as you get into the justification, well, Mrs. Brown, we went through this, and this, and this, that just fuels them, because they're just going to lash out at anything. They don't understand what you're saying. They don't care what you're saying. All they're doing is you're giving them more oxygen because of your justification. Another phase or stage that they go through is what's called bargaining. And that's a stage that's filled with the if only statements that you may hear clients talk about. And they might say something like, you know, what if, or if only we'd done this. So if only we'd got pet insurance, if only I didn't ignore that lump and got it removed sooner. You know, if only I had been here on time and I was able to actually get this operation happening, or if I had enough money to have this operation. So what they're doing is they're bargaining with themselves. And they might even say, I should have got another vet. If only I'd got another vet for another second opinion, why would this, you know, Fluffy wouldn't be dead now. So the point is, once again, don't get caught up into justifying or taking offense or feeling like this is a discrediting of your credentials or your professionalism. What it is it's about them going through a process of, could I have changed the outcome? And people do this quite frequently because death and loss is outside people's control on the whole. You know, they may have run their vet, they may have run the, not the vet, that's a that's now becoming Freudian slip. They may have run the dog over in the driveway, but, you know, on the whole, death is outside people's control. And so the bargaining is trying to deal with that loss of control.
So even if it's like retrospectively thinking, it's still helping them feel like as if they could have had control, where they actually can't change that. There's no, they can't go back in time.
That's correct. That's correct. And you hear that people do that with humans as well. If only we had taken this step. And so it is about exactly what you just said then, Gerardo. It's about people retrospectively going back in time to a time when they had no control, and they're trying to now assert some control over it. It's a common psychological process because, on the whole, humans hate losing control. They want control. They want the power. They want the decision-making. They want the control. Death takes that away from all of us. And so, therefore, people retrospectively try and impose that control because that then helps them grieve better. And so, it takes it away that it's not my fault.
Because when they go back to try to assert control, they realize that actually, they, even if they did then, they couldn't have changed it. It's kind of like, I can recognize that I've gone through these phases before. Especially the whole thing about going back in time and like, oh, if only I didn't drive my car through the creek, I'd probably still have it.
And there's a utility in that as well, because I'm just thinking just in terms of a work scenario. Let's say you lose that patient. I don't know if this is grief or not, but it's that just that going over of, if only I'd given that drug or I should have done that scan. And I suppose it's, is that your brain trying to learn to avoid that same mistake down the line as well? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So exactly what you just said, Hubert, that it is about, and as I said right in the beginning, that grieving and going through that loss process is about the learning. And so, yes, if something happened with a euthanasia, then, or something happened with a particular operation and the pet is now deceased, there is a learning around that, and there's a in the grieving process. So that's the positive that comes out of it. So if I turn into another stage, and that is the depression or a flatness that happens. And this happens, and this comes back to what Gerardo said about the connection and the strength of the bond. So you'll hear clients who are in this stage say things like, I don't know how I'm going to be without him. He's my reason for living. He's my reason for getting up in the morning. I'll be so lonely without her. And once again, like, he belonged to my deceased wife, my brother, my son. And so what happens here is it's due to those connections and the importance the pet has had that makes it even greater, the loss. And so they do become, and some can become extremely depressed, clinically depressed even, and that's where they really need to be linked in. The clients need to be linked back into their GPs because, you know, in those circumstances, what they're doing is they're going through the grief of their loved one all over again with the loss of the pet. So it becomes a double whammy. And I've had occasions where I've worked with vets where they've rung me and said, I'm really worried. He's gone home and I'm really worried. He lives on his own and I don't know if he's going to be okay. I don't know if this is going to be, you know, the turning point where he goes, life's just not worth living any longer. And so we've actually organised welfare checks. It's a extraordinary circumstance, but there are times when vets have been astute enough to say, I know he lives on his own. I know there's not much family around. I know because I've treated this dog for so many years. I know the wife's deceased. And so therefore I'd just like a welfare check on the client. And that does happen. As I said, extraordinary, but it does happen. And once again, that's really good vet execution there of executing the shift of responsibility away from the vet, because the vet's not responsible for the welfare of the client, but often they get caught up in that because they are the ones who know the intensity of the grief. And so to shift it onto a psychologist is a very appropriate step to take.
Yeah, I was about to say, would it be more appropriate that like the vet called the next day or the one of the reception team or nurses called the next day just to check? But I can get what you're saying there, but then all of a sudden you're shouldering that responsibility of the grief that the client's experiencing and then potentially taking on a responsibility that you're not trained for or don't have the capacity and skills to follow up with continually.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think that's where we really need to shift that responsibility, because when is enough enough? You know, and when we're talking about certainly after hours veterinary practices where they've got so many losses that are occurring, they may not have the same connection that perhaps a traditional practice has, but nonetheless, you know, if you're trying to actually organise ongoing support, it is much better to transfer that onto a psychologist. That's their modus operandi. They can deal with what's appropriate and escalate the support that's required for the clients, because they can then do their own assessment. Your assessment as the vets has been in what's occurred with the animal and being able to do the best possible or deal with the unexpected outcomes.
I just had this terrible thought just then, which is like, your job as the vet is to dwell on it and then go, I should have done that test earlier. I should have. go through your own grief process. But yeah, that was a joke.
But at some level.
But it happens, but it will happen as a vet.
Absolutely. Can I just say, let's put it out there, because it will happen. Because the vet will go over the process and say, did I do everything the best way? Could I have done those tests earlier? Could I have done this? So they go through their own grieving process of the if only. So whilst you're seeing this happen with the client, let's also say the vet and the nurse even may go through the same process of grief. Maybe a quicker process, but nonetheless, you'll see stages of this as the vet is checking their own professionalism of what they did.
Can I ask you for some tools or for some words here? You're so good at this language. So let's say I'm in that room and the client has that depression and they say, I don't know what I'll do. I don't know if I can live without this dog, you know, any of those sort of things. And you're in the room and you've got to say something to look human and to express concern and then also advise them to seek help. What do you say? Like, I find this so hard. They go, oh, this was my wife's dog. I'm so broken. And then you just go, there. You'll be fine.
Yeah, and
I'll send the police the welfare check you tomorrow. Sorry, I spoke in the bear.
Yeah, we care and love you. Here are the police.
Pay your bill on the way out.
I think what's important, Hubert, is just to say to them, you know, it's an acknowledgement of how precious this animal was to them. And so it's just confirming that. And so it's just saying, I can see, Bill, just how deeply you loved Fluffy, and also you loved your wife or you loved your son. Because when they bring another family member into it, you need to bring them in too. And so all you're doing is acknowledging that. And you can actually say that multiple times. It'll feel like a broken record for you. But I tell you what, from the client's perspective, they'll probably only ever hear it once.
Okay.
So you can just keep on saying, I can see how important Fluffy was and what the deep connection and the deep love that you've had for Fluffy and for your wife. And then if you find that the person's still sobbing and the person is still really inconsolable at that time, then that's when you can say, I'd really recommend that we organize to meet with your GP, or we actually get a psychologist through a welfare, you know, counseling to assist you, so that you can only offer that. It's not your responsibility to make sure it happens. It's the client's responsibility. And the same for the vet. Let's get back into the vets and the vet nurses. If you see that they're stuck in one of these stages and really grappling with it, we too need to give them that same support. And I'd like to speak about that in a moment, about practical things, but certainly we need to give them that support as well. So it's once again not their colleagues, or as I heard in a practice the other day, when a woman who came in after she'd done her first euthanasia, and she was at reception, and unfortunately other clients could hear this, and they said to her, so how'd you go? And she said, awful. It was absolutely dreadful. Tears start rolling down her face. Reception turn around and say, don't worry, suck it up. You'll have another one later on in the shift.
Well, this is, we laugh, but this is why we need to talk about this, because that's, yeah, that's kind of what we are taught.
I didn't mean to laugh, saying that, like, that's so, but it's just like, I can totally imagine that happening to me.
If it's not said verbally, yeah, there's often an attitude that kind of says that.
Exactly. And in the same practice, one who didn't speak just turned around and started typing on a computer. So it, as you said, non-verbally, the behavior said, you know, we can't deal with this, or you've just got to deal with it yourself. So let me just briefly go through the last stage of this, and that's the acceptance. And that's when our vets or the clients, that, you know, they've moved to realizing the death has happened, and they do need, you know, life will go on. And so the client will say, you know, I'm a bit relieved, he's not suffering now, or I feel like I'm so lucky to have such lovely memories. So once again, remember, this is not linear. So you might get one client that goes straight to this acceptance as soon as they've been euthanized. And they'll start talking about the beauty of the bond, the bravery of the pet, the joy that the pet has given them, and all the memories. And they'll start to go into storytelling. I remember when Fluffy was born. You know, I remember when she had her first litter. And that's really encouraging, that they share the stories, because that's once again them coming to terms with what's happened and the acceptance of what's happened. And so and some of them may immediately, and I've heard it, immediately start speaking about a replacement pet. So the one's actually still there and they're talking about the replacement pet, and that's okay.
It's like my kids. When we euthanized our dog, we were expecting major, major sadness, and we told them the sad news, and they sat there for a second, and the one went, can we get a puppy?
and that's okay. So as I said, there are all those stages. They're not linear. People can jump and miss some, stay in some, get fixed, but they're the ones that you will see happen. And so I think for me, if let's look at the vets, because I'd like to look at them, not the clients.
Just regarding this acceptance one, right? Okay, because I can identify with all of these stages that I've seen it so many times, but it's great to see it in stages. And I can understand it's a continuum. They go back and forward, that the time they spend in the stage varies. But with this acceptance one, can you, sometimes I find that you can shift them into acceptance.
Yeah.
Like with a line. So, did you have Fluffy ever since she was a puppy? And then, then they're like.
A classic one.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, Fluffy was so small. And I remember when she loves playing with the ball. Oh, she loves playing with the ball. She loves going to the beach. Oh, the beach. Oh, the beach was so amazing. And then starts the storytelling mode of, and then makes them, I feel it makes them feel gratitude in a time of, and gratitude and love in a time of loss. But I don't know if that's even the right thing to do.
I think it's the right thing to do because they then reminisce and recall the good times. So what you're doing is you're doing a lovely balance. Whilst there's a great deal of sadness, there's also a great deal of joy.
And that's okay, is it?
It is.
Because from listening to what you're talking about, the stages, are we not denying them?
No, because they'll go back.
I was going to say, so you're just delaying it to a more convenient time, basically.
Yeah, they'll go back to other previous stages, or, you know, as I said, some will miss stages, but it's quite okay when you're with them to say, you know, have you had Fluffy for a long time? And yes, that does lead them into their storytelling, or, you know, you might say, what's the one beautiful thing that you remember about Fluffy? And then they just launch into their storytelling. And it's a great way of people in a constructive way being able to share their bond.
Okay.
Thanks. So it's quite healthy to do. So I think, you know, when we look at vets and we're seeing them go through the grieving stages, the things that we have to be alert to is, and it ties in with what Gerardo was saying about them reflecting on what they did during that operation or what they've done for Fluffy leading up to it, the tests and stuff. So you want to actually see how much rumination goes on. So how much do they repeat, I should have, or have I done, or did I do enough? You know, a few times is okay, but if you're getting it that it's happening repeatedly, that they keep on revisiting a particular one or multiple ones simultaneously, that's a warning sign. If we're seeing people really have what I call a flatness at work, so their normal bubble goes, or their normal way of working goes, and you get a monotone way they operate. You hear it in their voice, you hear it in their behavior, you see it in their behavior, and you sort of, I call it the flatlining. That's a sign that they've got stuck somewhere in the grief.
So is that the same as numbness? Like sometimes you like so much happens. Maybe that's different. Maybe because I was just thinking before when you're going through the stages, I was wondering if there's a numb stage where you just go like, it's too much, and you just go.
Yeah, and that's a denial has a numb stage, has a numb part in it. So denial, okay. You know, I talked about them ask questions or what do you mean by this? For clients and for vets, they just, particularly vets, they don't have any experience of emotion. So they can't connect with their emotions.
Okay, so what do we do about that?
I think what is important, if people get stuck in that numbness, and you'll know it because they can't connect with any, can't share any emotions, or if they are talking about emotions, it's just words, and you know by the look of them, it means nothing to them. It's just, you know, the word depressed, the word happiness have the same degree of bubble to them. And so I think what's important is that there is feedback to the individual vet privately to say, you know, what I'm seeing in you is that disconnect between what you're saying and how you're looking, or what you're saying and how you're feeling. And so we need to look at what's causing that disconnection, because the longer there's that disconnect, this is, you're not saying this to them, but for you to know, the longer you have the disconnect, the greater the risk of cumulative trauma and post-traumatic stress.
All right. Because the disconnect is just what you're just not processing. You just pushing, shoveling it away down to some deep pit, and all of a sudden all the demons are going to come out in one go and go,
and exactly. Then... And what often happens is they keep shoving it down into a pit and everything gets there and a lid gets put on it. And then it's the simplest of things that opens up that lid and it explodes. And I can share with my own experiences, my own self once, where I just had so many things happening, and I had personally my mother going through dementia, and or everything happening in the hospital, had a whole lot of shit going down with clients, and I was just burying it all. I just couldn't process it, and I was burying it until I ran over a cat in the street. And not only did I just get so worked up about the cat, but the lid just blew. And I'm standing in the middle of bloody Doncaster Road with four lanes of traffic, sobbing my heart out, and people are trying to pull me away from the cat. And I just wouldn't leave the cat, and I just wouldn't leave in the middle of the road. And all these cars are piling up around me. And the police had to, in the end, physically take me off the road.
Wow.
So that's why, like, everything comes up and there's just like, are you guys okay? And you think, like, you ask the staff member, like, are you okay today? They're like, oh, you know, that cat was, you know, and all of a sudden it was like my mom and my partner and the toast burnt this morning and then my car, and it's like everything's just boof.
Exactly. It's the straw that broke the camel's back, and it's all of a sudden everything explodes. And I think, you know, I learned from that, you know, about how just burying it, it never goes away. And so it comes back at a wrong time, and it comes back at such a ferocity. It's saying, hey, look at me. You can't forget me, and I'm going to make sure I'm in your face to process.
So what did that look like for you, Rhonda, when you're in that shoving it away stage? Were you flat and down, or were you just normal, Rhonda, too busy to face the shit that's going on in your life?
I'd gone into the flatlining.
Yeah, okay, so you were.
Yeah. So there was all this flatlining going on, and I just kept on pushing that shit away. And then I was just processing surgeons, specialists, you know, going through the motions of what was needed. You know, my mother was needing an amputation because she had diabetes then, because of all the other things that were going on. So it became, if you like, this cocktail of things, trauma happening at the same time. And that one cat, and I'm not taking away how sad it was that the cat died, and I hit the cat as it ran across the road, but the reaction from me was it then brought out everything else.
So what should you have done in that stage? Because the reality is you had stuff that had to be done. Like, you couldn't have, should you just tap out and say, listen, I can't do this right now. I need to deal with what I'm feeling first. Or what's that?
Yeah, I think my girlfriend did the best thing. So she's also a psychologist, and she came. This is when we didn't have too much happening in the way of electronic diaries, and we had hard copy diaries. She walked up to my diary, she ripped out the pages, and she said, "So you're not seeing any more clients now, and you're going to start dealing with your mum's shit." And I tell you what, that was a real, that I needed that. I need someone to just to say, you can't keep on pushing yourself and just keep on doing the day-to-day stuff and have all this other crap on top of you and think you can cope with it all. You know, you feel like you're a superhuman, but at the end of the day, you've got to pull back on something so you can actually deal with it. And I think that for me was a huge learning.
Wow.
So that's a sharing some experience around when you get to that stage of where it's like a pressure cooker and all of a sudden it blows.
I don't know if I'm skipping ahead. Sorry if I'm disrupting your flow, but I want to just keep digging there. What does dealing with your shit look like? So you had to deal with what was going on in your life. Does that mean going to speak to somebody?
I think it's a multitude of things. I think it's, yeah, certainly speaking to somebody, and which, you know, if I have a look at this in this particular occasion for me, which is I did, because, you know, dementia is a very confronting thing. And I think what the key part for me was, this psychologist said to me, "You've lost your mum." And it sounds really easy now, but right there, that was exactly what I hadn't accepted, that I'd lost my mother, even though she was still there in person. The dementia had meant that we had lost her. And that's when I was actually starting, I gave myself permission to actually accept that in the grieving process. And that enabled me to move on. And it was because I hadn't reached that acceptance. I was into denial. I was into all those stages we talked about, anger, you know, I was just spitting out at everything. And I'll share a story about that, because in the anger, there I was, and I'd just driven up to meet this psychologist for the first time. And all of a sudden, my car decided that it was going to go for a major wobble as well. And I'm standing out the front, and inside the car, I couldn't get out of the bloody car. And it's, the windows are going up and down. The sunroof's going up and down. The bloody motor wouldn't go off. And I'm going, for fuck's sake, what's going on here? And I'm feeling bad. Now the car's feeling bad. And I walked in, and I was ripe. I was ready for her to just
fuck me. I would have been totally intimidated to try to be a psychologist for you, Rhonda. I'd be like, fuck me. How did I pick this badass short straw? There's something that I've recently because with my encephalitis and kind of accepting where I am with regards to my recovery and my cognitive deficits and things, but also adjustments in my role within Animal Emergency Service and Animal Emergency Australia, stepping aside from hospital directorship role, there was so many things that I was I was grieving the loss of a change in identity. I was grieving a loss of capability, and then trying to understand and see where I could go, what I could do, and so forth. And there was a stage where I couldn't get access to help. I had coaches, I have a performance coach. I had one then. I still have one continuously. But then I actually finally got in to see a psychologist. It took me 3 months. And due to a cancellation, and I didn't really feel like I needed it. But then when I went, it was like, holy shit, this was the thing that I needed. Like, I was shoveling shit down into a hole and then kind of disconnecting with it. But then what I feel now, having numerous sessions, was that sometimes I don't even feel like I need to go. But when I go, it's like as if the door opens and I empty out that little dark pit of something. It's like a maintenance thing now, which I never really thought was valuable, but I can see now it's critical for my ongoing performance, just in life in general.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that a maintenance thing?
Yeah, no, it's a really good way of describing it. And it is. It's like when you open up, and you're able to share what's going on. And sometimes we can't put words to it. So it comes out very bumbly and irrational and very disparate, but it really doesn't matter. It's coming out, and it's the flow of that enables people to just offload. And then, you know, the value of a psychologist is to be able to frame up some of that, and having good colleagues can actually frame up some of that and just give real recognition, acceptance, reinforcement, and just that positiveness that can come out of it. And then, as you say, the ongoing part is just to open that pit. Other people say get the rubbish bin and throw the rubbish out, and we do need that. We all need that culling, if you like. You know, we declutter our lives with, you know, we go through our wardrobes and we throw out all the old stuff we can't fit into.
No, not me. I hoard it.
Well, you're then my target then, Hubert, that I need to declutter your brain and your mind and your emotions.
Yeah, probably not wrong.
but it is. It is, you know, that at different points in the grieving or different points in stress, that it's firstly identifying what our triggers are. It's identifying how we react to them and how we process them and what we can do as actions. But then it's about how do we maintain that? So that's what you're talking about, Gerardo. As you rightly said, it is about that identification. It is about naming it, giving it a framework so that people can see the normality of it. And because once we actually name it or identify it, it's then tangible for us to work on. Before that, it's effusive. It's just out there and you can't grab it. And that's when it becomes so frustrating. But once you've identified it or acknowledged it or being able to give a framework around it, then you're in a position, it comes back to control, then you're in a position to say, okay, what's going to be my strategies now to be able to deal with this or process it or move past this or accommodate this in my life? And that's what you're referring to. So if we look at vets who are going through a grieving process themselves, I think it's really important that we talk about, and we've heard a lot about it through COVID, but let's talk about it in just death and dying and in trauma. It's about giving people the framework, and that's what Gerardo is talking about, the new normal, so that people are actually understanding that they're going to get through things. And so it legitimizes what they're experiencing, because people often say, is this normal? Should I be feeling this way? You know, I don't normally have bad night's sleep, or I don't normally feel sick, or I don't normally have put off my food. And so it's normalizing that. And so they know what they have a sense of what it means. It then gives legitimacy to what they're experiencing, which then enables them to move on. And that's critical for vets, because vets on the whole are high-performing individuals who are very much always putting themselves out there as, I've got to be perfect. So they're perfectionists.
I feel like we skipped over something. We sort of sidetracked you, or was that it there?
I guess the other thing I'd like to say when we talk about individuals dealing with it is it's being comfortable with what I'd call a good death and the grief of the process. So, you know, it comes back to what you said right in the beginning, that often we avoid talking about it. And we've got to name it. We've got to call it. And people have got to feel comfortable. You know, vets have got to feel comfortable with death and grief. And so talking about what does a good death look like is really important for vets. And I find that when I'm talking to them. So when, you know, there's been euthanasia, to be able to look at how do they respect the patient? How do they support the owner? So if you like, there's that good death process of taking into account all people involved. And I think that's a really important part, because a lot of clients don't actually have someone else. And the vets are in a very, very special role of understanding and having the empathy around the loss for a client. Because other people will just say, oh, get over it. It was only an animal.
That was a really powerful thing that, well, I resonate with me, right? What does a good death look like? What came to mind there is, and you said, like, how do they respect the patient? How do they support the owner? So and you said the whole entire team, that's not just the vet, it's the reception team, the nurses who help and assist, and also help with the bagging of the body after, help with putting the body into the cold room or freezer or whatever it may be. Like that, the whole process from start to end. And the point I'm going to get to is, if as a team, you go through the exercise of start to end, the whole entire euthanasia experience, from the phone call to how the client comes in, what the reception team says, or what the person on the phone says, like right to the end of like a follow-up call and a, you know, card, like that whole entire, almost like the client and patient experience through that whole entire process. And then if the whole team feels like as if they created the best experience of euthanasia, would that help the whole team kind of just walk away from the whole euthanasia process going, that's a beautiful experience, that we are honored to be able to offer that experience?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good way of putting it. It is about that entire journey. And as you say, from the embers, it's a high emotional journey. And so there's heightened demands right from the first phone call right through to the end. And so if it's seen as an entirety, as you're saying, that takes it away from an individual trying to deal with it, and it's the entire team's role and contribution to that experience. How do we deal with them in the front office? How do we deal with the animal? How do we deal with post-death? And as you say, the bagging, talking about cremation, talking about, you know, footprints, you know, a piece of fur, those sorts, scrapbooking, all of those things. Some people like to donate money for animal charity, planting a tree, you know, all those things that people want to do for a commemoration is part of that experience, that journey that the veterinary team go through with the client, because everyone is part of that team at that moment, whether that be an hour, whether that be days or weeks even, you know, it might have started with looking at a lump and right through to the end. So there's different time factors here, but nevertheless, there is that journey that everyone's on. And I think it is important, as you're saying, Gerardo, is that if people actually feel, how do we want to have and create a good death, then it takes away from the individual's experiences to a collective team experience. And that, from a psychological perspective, is much healthier and reduces the risk of, what have I done wrong? Or what could I have done differently? Yes, we can all learn, but it takes away the blame, takes away my self-doubt. It takes away from the individual, and it gives the ownership, if you like, to the whole team.
Is it a good idea to offer some resources to your clients in a situation like that, to have, you know, maybe a couple of numbers of somebody to speak to? So if you're having, expect this, because I've said it to owners in the past where they seem almost surprised by how upset they are, especially males, young males. They like, they look almost embarrassed that I'm upset. And then I'll say to them, look, it's not a small thing. You are going to go through a grief process. But then again, I lack the language around it. So maybe a booklet or something to say, there we go, with your bill, there's your resources too.
Well, and I think that's quite okay to do. Yes, to give it like a pet grief counsellor or a local psychologist, or if you've got an employee assistance program, that might be for the veterinary staff. Some EAPs also offer initial consultation with the client. So there's those things, you know, and there's also 1-800 numbers across Australia for grief counselling. It's 24/7. So I think it's a great idea, just a list of them. And in the same little pack, you can also give all those details around the different ideas people might like to have as commemoration. And so it can be sharing that people may say, look, it's too early, I can't think about it at the moment, but you're giving them ideas for them to reflect on after they've left. And let's be honest, there's some people who just want to get out of that clinic as fast as they can. Yeah. They don't want to talk. They're out of there. But I've got to tell you, some of them sit in their cars for hours on end, or they just drive away. They just want to get out of the remembering of what's just happened there. Mm. And others just want to sit with you and don't want to leave. And we've got to also say there's a parallel for the vets and the vet staff, that when they've just done an euthanasia or they've had a series of them, you know, a hard thing is to then all of a sudden have online that the next job they're doing is a puppy vaccination. That can be really confronting because they're going from life end to beginning of life. And that can be a big emotional swing. And so I'd avoid, if you could, if you're a manager, being able to avoid that sort of psychological swing in a shift, because then that blocks the grieving for some people, because they're trying to reconcile, I've just put one down and now here's a new life beginning.
My partner Alex thinks that I'm a robot in terms of emotions and empathy. I feel like I could go from a euthanasia experience to a bright, happy dog experience within 10 seconds, 20 seconds. I don't know, it's just because it's years of experience and time. It was a protective mechanism to almost just like gone. I wonder whether or not I've got this really big, deep pit of clients and patients.
Yeah. Can I expand on that even? So let's take it outside of work, because we are veterinarians, but primarily we're humans, and grief comes to us all. But what if it doesn't? What if there's something that happens that you go, all right, I'm waiting for it, but I seem fine, things are just carrying on. Is that a denial thing? Should you be? Well, let me share. It might help somebody else, but I worry about that. I lost my dad earlier this year to COVID, and he's in South Africa, so we couldn't see him. Very traumatic experience. And of course, there was it was a stressful period, but I worry that I'm not sad enough. I'm wondering, am I sitting on a landmine that's going to explode when I run over a cat or something like that?
Hmm. And I guess, you know, once again, Hubert, and thank you for sharing something very dear to you. But, you know, once again, one size doesn't fit all. Hmm. And so just because I went into a major meltdown doesn't mean you will. Okay. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you're in denial. I think all I say to people is just give yourself the space, the emotional and mental space, just to reflect and just to connect with your dad, for instance, you know, just so then it's not just being shoved away or as Gerardo and I were talking about, putting it in a pit. It's remembering him. It's a bit like what we're saying about the veterinary clients. It's the same as with when we lose loved ones. It's giving ourselves that space to remember their idiosyncrasies, their nuances, you know, some funny jokes they used to share about them as a person. And it's just connecting with that is what's important, but giving yourself the space to do so. That could be having a walk, that can be talking to other family members. That's important, because as long as you've got that connection, then that actually gives you the passage to do the grieving at whatever level or whatever way is right for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What upon eliciting that, let's say like we're going through the process of euthanasia and, you know, we feel like we're delivering a good death experience. The transition of between the euthanasia process and then straight into something different. Now that I think about it, I think that the acceptance part, the stories that the clients share about their pet and seeing the love and seeing the connection in the room between the grief that I see, I see the grief as love, like expressing love, and the stories and delivering that good death experience is almost cathartic for me. Like I can walk out the door and go, I did my job. Hmm. Now I feel like it's rather sad, but I feel grateful that I've been able to deliver that experience. I feel that really helps me move forward really quickly.
And you're quite right. Some vets say that often, that there's that cathartic or sense of closure for them because they have left that bond, they have seen that bond, and that gives them a great deal of energy. And so they're not depleted, they're actually energized by it. Whereas some people do get depleted. So we need to recognize some, like yourself, walk out and can, you know, go and do a puppy vaccination or feel quite okay about it. Others, and I think it depends on what else is going on in people's lives, it can feel like the bucket's draining rather than the bucket filling. I think it's what's going on in anyone's life right there at that time means what are their resources and their agility and how their mind is flexible and what their resilience is. And if they're already depleted because they're not sleeping well, they're grieving about the loss of something else in their lives, then they're much more vulnerable. And when we're vulnerable, we get whacked easier when it comes to other emotional things happening in with our clients. And so therefore, rather than building us, it can deplete us. And so then people feel drained, exhausted. That's when you hear the language of them saying, I don't know if I can keep going with this. And that's when a manager really needs to have listening to that language, because that then needs to be looked at. What's the schedule of other jobs that are on for the day? Is there space where they could have a breather, where they could go for a walk? Just so then you're breaking it up so you're not just banging on one thing on top of another for someone who's already showing signs of that vulnerability and that depletion.
I suppose we've got to wrap this up. This is so good, Rhonda.
You've been so generous with your time, and I think that's going to be really useful. I've learned a lot.
Yeah. I've been able to reflect a lot as well.
Yeah, that was pretty tough.
So, you know, I want people to, when they hear this, is to see that, you know, grief is a positive experience. Whilst we have enormous pain with it, when Gerardo talks about correlation, our pain comes from enormous joy. So we've got both sides of that. You know, it's when we have the joy, when we have the satisfaction, when we have those bonds, when we can really connect, and equally we feel what others are going through. That's a positive thing. And what we need to make sure is that we give ourselves that space, give ourselves the acknowledgement of how it's affected us. Because, you know, the three of us could be in the same surgery and have three very different reactions to the death of that pet. And that's because of what's going on in each of our lives, what else is happening with our resilience, and how we've actually processed that and how we see ourselves at that time and our contribution and just the way in which we're operating. Those things are all very important, and the learning out of it and the, you know, you talked about growth, there is growth out of that. And the thing that we want to make sure is that we see any triggers or any warning signs that say people are getting stuck. And if they're getting stuck, then that's the time we really need to act, so that we don't just say, okay, like the example I gave in that practice, that we're just saying, let's just keep on piling up more and more shit until someone gets to a brick wall.
Amazing. Awesome. Rhonda, thank you as usual.
Thanks.
That's really powerful. Have a lovely weekend.
Cheers. Thank you.
Our goal here at The Vet Belt is to have conversations like the one you've just listened to. It will give you inspiration and fresh ideas on how to create a thriving and happy career and life as a vet. You'll know by now that our focus is on the life skills that we need to navigate this challenging and rewarding profession of ours. But there's something that I've realized over the last few years of exploring ways to increase enjoyment of the job. That is that the vets who are confident in their skills and knowledge are, as a whole, more satisfied with their careers. Which makes sense. When you feel rusty or uncertain in your knowledge, it's very easy for those imposter feelings to sneak in. I don't know enough. Am I good enough? Conversely, we know that feelings of growth and mastery are some of the greatest predictors of a happy career, which is why we created the VetVault Clinical Podcast. 3 highly practical episodes every week. Conversations, not lectures, with world-class specialists. Tips, updates, real insights, not textbook theory. Short enough to listen to on your drive to work, but with enough content to ensure that you'll be a little bit better at your job than you were before you listened. Join us on our journey to better by trying out our free 2-week trial at vvn.supercast.com.